Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, October 20th, 2015. We open today with theme music for the Keystone Cops. And it's the perfect way to set up our first couple of stories about the idiots who run the surveillance state here in the United States of America. The Fourth Amendment that requires probable cause and a warrant before you can be searched? It's optional when the spooks come to play. And of course, our government and the intelligence community continue to tell us that they need to be able to hack into our email and our internet traffic in order to keep us safe. But yesterday it was revealed that the top spy in the United States, the most powerful spook in the world, John Brennan, director of the Central Intelligence Agency, had his email account hacked by a 13-year-old described as a stoner. And get this, John Brennan uses an AOL account. Now, I still have many friends who I get emails from who use an AOL account, and I often say to them, when are you going to take off the training wheels? You know. But why on earth would the CIA director not only use an AOL account for his personal email, but the account included sensitive information, including his own security clearance application? Now, John Brennan has had a security clearance for more than 25 or 30 years. He's been at the CIA that long. So why would his email account have a copy of his clearance application? That is just bizarre. Also included in the information that was tweeted out by this 13-year-old, social security numbers of several CIA officers. Again, why would John Brennan have that in a private email account? And why is he using AOL? This is just absurd. And of course, this is pointed out by Trevor Tim today in a commentary at the Guardian newspaper. He said that Brennan has been openly accused of leaking classified information to the press, for which someone else was punished. He even admitted to orchestrating a hacking himself when he ordered his underlings to spy on the computers that Senate staff members were using to research the CIA torture review. And so will John Brennan be disciplined for this breach of his security? I mean, it's on the level of what Hillary is accused of for maintaining her own private server that reportedly was the subject of attempted hackings from Russia. No, John Brennan will keep his job. Because, well, he's got the goods on Obama. He ran the drone program from the White House during the first term. But you can expect the 13-year-old will be facing some music. And I'll just draw this comparison. A young teen in Saudi Arabia who didn't hack anybody, but he called a protest, attended a protest, and emailed other people to join him. He is facing beheading and crucifixion. So what will the U.S. do to teach a lesson to future hackers to stay away from the CIA director's AOL account? And Jay Johnson over at Homeland Security, the cabinet officer there, apparently the same kids hacked into a private Comcast account of his. And get this, the kids were able to trick AOL into giving up Brennan's password by calling the customer service department. I mean, this is just so stupid. We pretend that the keepers of our secrets are guardians of their own security and would never for a moment allow that to lapse. Now, here's another amusing story about the national surveillance state, courtesy of our friend Jason Leopold, the frequent FOIA filer, who finally got a response from the National Security Administration from a request that he filed almost 2 years ago. That's because Keith Alexander, who was running the NSA at the time, went to a hackers convention in Las Vegas in 2013 and he asked them to help the NSA come up with ways to protect Americans' privacy and civil liberties. Keith Alexander, how do we start this discussion on defending our nation and protecting our civil liberties? So he gave the hackers an email address where they could send their suggestions. And it turns out that a grand total of 14 people sent emails to the suggestion department at the NSA. I mean, this is very funny. And one guy offered a mathematical way to collect information on American citizens. Another person who claimed to hold a top secret clearance had an idea for a tokenization system that takes all incoming data, encrypts the original data for storage in a place that no user has direct access to. Brilliant. That'll protect my privacy rights. The same guy said if the NSA was interested in discussing the proposal, just to give him a call. I did actually give you my cell number above. Not that you couldn't have found it anyway. I mean, this is so ludicrous. And let's see, there's also some fan mail from people who believe that the NSA is doing fine and they're willing to give up their rights to remain safe and keep on doing a great job. And then this one. An idea sent to NSA on February 6, 2014 suggested the agency could equip drones with facial recognition, weapon detection, and a stun gun, and place them in locations where risk of violence is high. This reads like a sci-fi writer. Once a face and a weapon have been detected, the drone would swiftly fly to the target and fire electrodes at the intruder, thereby incapacitating them and allowing the weapon to be secured by personnel it trusts. What did they think they were going to get? This is so hard to believe. Now, speaking of drones, you know that hobbyists who fly unmanned aerial vehicles have gotten a lot of flack in recent months. We had problems here in California during these massive wildfires where amateur drone flyers were sending their drones up to get pictures of the fires. And the firefighters complained that their own aircraft couldn't fly when these drones were in the air. Now, I find that pretty ridiculous. It's kind of like the rule, you know, that you can't use your cell phone in a plane because it'll disrupt the navigation. I mean, we know that's bullshit. And I don't know why the firefighters just didn't shoot the drone out of the air. I wouldn't have had any problem with that. Governor Jerry Brown vetoed a couple of bills that would have regulated drone flights in California. He did sign one that basically bans paparazzi from using drones to take nude pictures of Jennifer Lawrence out by her pool in Beverly Hills. But now the federal government is getting involved, and Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox has announced the setup of a task force of 25 to 30 people. They're going to come up with a way to register drones so that if I buy one and violate your privacy or violate airspace regulations, they'll at least know where the drone came from. Now, that's a fairly sensible kind of approach. But it shows the double standard, because they are very concerned about use of drones by private individuals in the United States. They're projecting 700,000 will be sold this Christmas. And the FAA is getting about 100 reports each month from pilots who say they've seen drones near planes and airports. So I can understand that a registration program makes sense. But when are we going to apply the same kinds of rules to the federal government's use of unmanned aerial vehicles? Because not only are these drones unregistered, we pretend that they are secret. And the program isn't secret. The dead bodies aren't secret. But the government has prevailed upon the courts to allow a curtain of secrecy to be draped over the drone program. And the ACLU is trying to fix that. They're pressing ahead with a lawsuit to force the CIA to turn over basic information about the drone warfare program. They seek summary data from the CIA on drone strikes, including locations, dates, number of people killed, identities or status of the victims. Jamil Jaffer, quote, "The case is really about the public's right to know, the right of access to information about this very controversial set of policies. At this point, the enemies of the United States already know that CIA is carrying out drone strikes. The only effect of the kind of secrecy we're seeing now is to keep Americans in the dark about their own government's policies. Well, I fully support the ACLU effort in this regard. We also need to see the white paper from the Justice Department that purports to justify the use of drones for targeted killings of Americans, like Anwar al-Awlaki. And today, there is an interesting commentary by a legal scholar over at Al Jazeera America. The scholar is Arjun Sethi, a writer and lawyer in Washington who also teaches law at Georgetown University. And he argues that in the limited comments that President Obama made in May of 2013 about the drone program, he said that he takes responsibility for it. He said viable targets were limited to terrorists who pose a continuing imminent threat to U.S. persons. Strikes are executed only where there's near certainty that the target is present, near certainty that non-combatants will not be injured or killed, and that capture is not feasible at the time of the operation. Well, we've killed far more people than we've attempted to capture. And the law professor here, Sethi, notes that the recent documents leaked to The Intercept show that Obama's claims are at best misleading and at worst false. That's a pretty polite way to say that he has deceived us. Goes on to say, although Obama signs off on targets, he generally doesn't sign off on strikes. He thus cedes execution authority to the military and has little to no knowledge of the potential number of civilians affected by a strike. The documents cast significant doubt on the claim that U.S. targets only those who pose a continuing imminent threat. The documents note that the military has 60 days after presidential approval to execute that, and a lot can change in 60 days. It also claims that the near certainty standard offered by Obama is not likely maintained. Again, a polite way of saying it's a lie. And he notes, as we reported last week, that The Intercept documents show that during Operation Haymaker in Afghanistan, drone strikes killed 35 targets and 200 civilians. That's hardly precision, and it doesn't show a great concern for the loss of innocent life. So, that's an interesting piece. Also, on the surveillance front, Connor Friedersdorf, an excellent reporter who writes for The Atlantic, has exposed that the New York Police Department is now using military-grade vans that are outfitted with X-ray radiation equipment. It can look through walls and look through the side of a truck to see what's in it. Police Commissioner Bill Bratton said, I will not talk about anything at all about this. It falls into the range of security and counterterrorism activity we engage in. They are not used to scan people for weapons, he said. But important questions arise. How's the police department making sure that New Yorkers are not subject to harmful X-ray radiation, including innocent people who just happen to be around when these vans are being, activated? How long are they keeping the images? Do they get a warrant before they take these images? And is this technology funded by taxpayer money? The vans cost about $800,000 apiece. And a state court has already ruled that the police department has to turn over its policies, procedures, training manuals that shape the use of X-rays. But New York City is fighting on appeal to suppress that information and more, as if it is some kind of spy agency rather than a municipal police department. That's well said, Mr. Friedersdorf. And we know that they've gone to great lengths to try to keep the Stingray surveillance system secret using non-disclosure agreements and claiming that local police departments who are allowed to use these devices can't actually talk about them because of bans by the FBI. And Friedersdorf reports that a judge who is reviewing the case in New York agrees with some of the concerns that are raised. Petitioner states and respondent does not dispute that backscatter technology previously deployed in European Union airports was banned in 2011 because of health concerns. And an internal report from American Science and Engineering says that these vans deliver a radiation dose 40% larger than those delivered by a backscanner airport scanner. And Friedersdorf notes that at least 50 U.S. law enforcement agencies have secretly equipped their officers with radar devices, and some of them have these X-ray gadgets. Every day I like to thank people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Jeffrey Lipinski, Faith Peoples, and let me turn the page here, Linda Clark. They are subscribers who have been with me for a long time, and I appreciate your support. And if you're not a subscriber, wouldn't you love to hear me mention your name sometime? A little shout-out, wouldn't that feel great? Well, all you have to do is come on over and subscribe. Go to peterbcollins.com. In the upper right-hand corner, click the menu. When that pull-down tab arrives, you click on Become a Subscriber. And on that next page, you can choose $5 a month, $10, $20, whatever fits your budget. You can make a one-time contribution of any amount via PayPal. There's a P.O. Box address there that you can use to mail in a check, a money order, or roll up a $100 bill. Somebody did that, and I'll take it. And, of course, we have the iPhone and iPad app now available at the Apple App Store. So please support me. I do need it. I try not to beg and wheedle and threaten and all that, but times are pretty tight here at pbc.com, and I've got to pay the webmaster for the upgrades to our website, so I could definitely use your support right now. Well, I'm surprised by the outcome of the election in Canada, where Stephen Harper, the Conservative Prime Minister, has been sent packing to be replaced by Justin Trudeau. And Trudeau, running in the Liberal Party, is promising to pursue legalizing recreational marijuana. He seems to want to address the climate change issue. It's not really clear to me what his position is on the Keystone XL pipeline, but I think from Canada's point of view, that's a settled issue. But I think it's going to be interesting. Trudeau has also promised to amend the sweeping anti-terrorism laws that Harper hammered through the Canadian Parliament in the last few months. And I certainly welcome that because I'm very concerned that if Canadians get used to draconian loss of civil liberties, that virus will cross the border. Anyway, I think it'll be interesting to see. Trudeau is young and handsome and he's got some tattoos. And there's some cautionary notes sounded in an op-ed in The Guardian today by Michelle Dean. She says that he'll be different. He is young and tattooed and bright-eyed and has good haircuts. But she says that she is concerned, first of all, about the idea that he is the descendant of a former prime minister. Now, I don't approve of dynasty politics, but Trudeau's father was prime minister 30 years ago. And so I don't consider that to be as egregious as the Bush and Clinton dynasties here in the United States. But there is concern, she writes, as a public speaker, Trudeau is mostly a campy disaster. A friend described his style as drama teacher sanctimony. And as a thinker, well, let's say he does not promise to be a match for President Obama. Well, that's a botched editing job, but I guess you get the idea of what they were trying to say. Jim Webb has pulled out of the Democratic presidential nomination process. He's threatening to run as an independent. And, he was polling at 1%. He had raised no money. He claims that as an independent, there are people who will fund his campaign. And, on the debate stage, Webb presented as a Republican, a neocon who is opposed to the Iran deal and who really has no place in the Democratic Party. That said, he bitched about how badly he was treated in the CNN debate, and he's right. They don't give equal time to all five candidates. They pull punches, and they feature the people who are front runners. And the purpose of these debates used to be for people to get acquainted with the candidates you don't know. But that's no longer facilitated by the corporate media in this country. And on that score, Webb has a legitimate gripe. Russia and the U.S. have signed a memorandum to avoid bombing each other and having planes make contact in the air over Syria while we are competing to see who can bomb that nation more than the other country. Yesterday, at a pretrial hearing for five of the Guantanamo Bay so-called high-level prisoners, Waleed bin Attash, a Yemeni accused of running an al-Qaeda camp in Afghanistan, fired his lawyers. And his lead attorney, Cheryl Borman, said he tells us that he doesn't know whether or not there's an FBI agent on his legal team. Why? Well, because there were FBI informants on other teams. He tells us as he sits here today that he has no idea if there's a CIA operative on his team. Why? Well, because in this bizarre setting, that actually has occurred. And this will certainly delay the proceedings, and he wants to represent himself, which is kind of complicated in a kangaroo court like the military commissions at Guantanamo. Also, I want to note that our good friend Andy Worthington has launched a campaign in Britain where people are fasting for 24 hours in solidarity with Shaka Amer's ongoing hunger strike at Guantanamo, and we're watching the calendar. He should be released in the next 10 days or so, unless the agreement with Britain is somehow changed. Both Texas and Louisiana are moving forward in their parts of the orchestrated takedown of Planned Parenthood. And this is so ugly, because we reported to you from a legal scholar a couple of weeks ago that when a legislature passes a bill that punishes an individual or an organization, it's called a bill of attainder, and it's explicitly unconstitutional. There is a clause that says no bills of attainder shall be permitted, or something like that. So in Texas, they've announced they're cutting off Medicaid funding to Planned Parenthood clinics, and they're linking it to the videos that were put forward by this pro-birth group. And that is, it's a complete violation of Planned Parenthood's rights. There has been no hearing to establish the alleged guilt that leads to this cutoff of funding. And it is just outrageous what is occurring. Bobby Jindal, who wishes he could be president, and he's running at the back of the Republican pack, he's ordered his state to block funding, but Planned Parenthood filed a lawsuit, and that is being put on hold for 14 days. But also in Louisiana, the state Senate, in a bill that is co-authored by an African-American Democrat named Katrina Jackson, has passed one of those pretextual bans on abortion. Now, it doesn't say abortion is outlawed. It says you can't have an abortion in a clinic where the doctor performing the procedure doesn't have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. This has been used in Texas and Utah and a bunch of other states. And if the Supreme Court ever does its job and accepts a case from one of these states that is intentionally seeking a Supreme Court ruling by goading it with these unconstitutional and obviously flawed gambits, well, we might get clarification that is long overdue. But what is interesting to note is that this pretext that, you know, these anti-abortion people claim they're only worried about the health of the women in these clinics. They're trying to protect them from these bad abortion butchers, right? Well, it turns out, for example, that the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says that abortions are so safe, with just 0.05% requiring hospital treatment, that hospital admitting privileges are not medically necessary. And how about this? When you compare the risk of medical problems from an abortion to those from colonoscopies, and a colonoscopy is a low-risk medical procedure, they put a tube up your butt, but the risk of mortality associated with a colonoscopy is 40 times higher than an abortion. And so it just shows how unscientific, how opportunist these anti-abortion activists are, and they are winning. They are prevailing. And reopening the shuttered clinics in Texas, reopening a shuttered clinic in Louisiana will be much more difficult than these efforts to close them. I commend the Guardian newspaper and its New York-based correspondent Spencer Ackerman for continuing to expose the wrongdoing of the Chicago Police Department. You've heard us talk about Homan Square. It's on the west side of Chicago. It's a warehouse-style building where more than 7,000 people have been taken for off-the-books interrogation and detention. Now, it turns out, and this won't surprise you, that the vast majority of people taken to Homan Square, 82%, are African-American. And only slightly less than 1% of the 7,185 arrests over 11 years followed the rules and allowed lawyers access to the person that they were holding there. So this is an extreme, egregious violation of procedures and of the rights of these defendants. And it continues under the support of Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who claims that they're all following procedure. And the lawyers who represent people who've been held there say it's like being disappeared. They're not allowed phone calls. They can't contact their family members. They just vanish. And some people are held there for days before they're actually booked into a jail in Chicago. So this is a stunning scandal, and the Tribune and Sun-Times in Chicago should be ashamed that they have been scooped by a London newspaper. The controversy continues in Afghanistan as the U.S. trotted out an Afghan general this week. I guess he's the Secretary of Defense or Defense Minister. And he claimed that the attack on the hospital in Kunduz was justified because there were Taliban insurgents and possibly Pakistani operatives who had used the hospital as a safe zone. But MSF, that stands for the French version of their name, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, has said flatly that the raid on October 3rd caused extensive, precise destruction to the hospital, where 70 staff members were treating 100 patients. They said there were no Taliban fighters in the building or even near the hospital. The compound was not entered by Taliban soldiers with weapons. What we have understood from our staff and guards is that there was very strong, very good control of what was happening in and around the compound, and they reported no firing in the hours preceding the destruction of the hospital. And witnesses confirmed no armed fighters were present in the hospital. But the spin machinery of the U.S. government is attempting to alter that reality. And finally today, it seems like the folks at ICE, which is a subdivision of the Homeland Security Department, are competing with the Secret Service, which is now also an offshoot of Homeland Security. And Secret Service had all these scandals where agents go to party countries and line up hookers and then don't pay them and they drink too much. And we got the episode of the White House where a supervisor was drunk when he came back and interfered with the investigation of an intruder one night. I mean, the hijinks by the Secret Service are now well known. Well, Immigration and Customs Enforcement seems to want to get into the game. And they are now investigating officials in San Diego because the reports are that a supervisor recruited employees on government time to participate in after-hours sexual swinger parties with him and his wife, who also works for ICE. And the parties apparently have occurred. Some employees felt they were pressured to participate. They were also uncomfortable because the parties occurred at the apartment of this couple, and they have kids who are watching a movie down the hall. Kids are told that mom and dad are working on a project with the other couples and not to disturb them or knock on the bedroom door for at least an hour. Wow. These are people with great judgment, wouldn't you say? The unnamed supervisor is said to have approached colleagues at work to ask if they wanted to come over to his house to engage in a swinger-style sex party. Using his personal phone, he also texted and emailed his coworkers while at work to tell them about the hanky-panky. Your tax dollars at work, friends. Don't you feel safe? Hey, thanks for listening all the way to the end of my news and comment podcast. Will you share this with a friend? Email it to a like-minded individual? I'd appreciate it. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.